Access number 28661, Mr. Ray Crisford, Reel 2. Now, you were at, after you joined the aircrew reception centre at St. John's Wood, you know, what happened next? You know, what's the next stage of your RAF training?
Well, we went straight by train down to what they called an ITW, an initial training wing, at Paignton.
Do you know which number?
No. But there was an ITW at Paignton and one at Torquay, just next door. And when we arrived there, we were on the seafront and put in two or three hotels, little hotels, which are not much more than boarding houses, that had been commandeered.
And what were they like as billets?
Well, I thought it was great because we had a bed and I was in a room with four. And we had a corporal who, as is usual, they referred to as sort of you dozy lot, get your hair cut and all that sort of nonsense. And we had, they'd commandeered a big car park in Paignton. And we used to go down there regularly every day for what seemed like hours drilling.
Now, how did you take to this kind of drilling? You'd done a bit in the Home Guard, but yeah. I mean, this is proper drilling now. What did you think of, how did you take to
drill?
I think
we all loved it. We want to be as smart as we could. I didn't dislike it. I thought it was great.
Any problems with it?
No.
Some people do have problems with drilling.
No, I know my left and my right. There's no problem over that.
So what other training were you doing during a typical day?
Oh, well, we had maths lessons, elementary meteorology, a bit of trigonometry.
Now, this is all relating to navigation.
Yeah.
How far into navigation were you going?
Well, the rudimental sort of aerodynamics, what makes an aircraft fly and why does it fly and... And we did some maths, meteorology, and we had exams. Because I know one lad who failed his maths and he was taken off the course. But I can't remember any other sort of educational lessons or anything.
Any other types of training? Any PT, physical training?
Oh, yeah.
What sort of...
Oh, well, that was usual. You had a pair of shorts and arms bend and touch your toes, and it was all a bit basic. But
any running or route marches or anything, you know?
No, the only route march we did was from the hotel to the hotel along the road where it was the mess.
Now, how were you getting on with the other lads? What sort of backgrounds were they from? How do you know the other recruits?
Well, they were all similar to me, really. I think. We were all dying to get into an aircraft.
Were they from the same sort of background as you? I mean, were they also sort of minor public school or private school, whichever way you look at, or were they a mixed background? Or
I don't think we ever discussed our backgrounds. We were just all mates together.
So no bullying or anything untoward?
Oh, no. No. No, the discipline was fairly lax. I mean...
So you got on well. How did you get on with the instructors, you know, the NCOs and the people teaching you?
Well, I suppose it was really like an extension of school. They were the people that were doing the lecturing or whatever, and you accepted them as being... And I think we used to refer to them as sir, if I remember rightly. We did in those days, even if it was only a corporal. That's my memory. Anyway.
Did they know this stuff? I mean, were they good instructors?
Well, they were good enough to get me through the exam so that I was able to go on. And I wasn't particularly bright or... I was just Mr. Average, really.
Any other sorts of training you were doing at Paignton?
No.
So just these lectures, Bit of PT, bit of drill.
Drill, yeah.
So how long were you there for? July to...
Some weeks. I think July through August and perhaps beginning of September. I expect it was an... And I can't remember how many weeks it was. It was a definite length of 6, 7, 8 weeks or whatever it was. I can't remember.
No. That's right across the high summer. Paddington's not a bad place to be, I presume. I mean, was there much to do? What sort of recreations did you...
Well, we were right by the seaside, and there was a small section of the beach where you could go in and swim. And we used to swim every day, either early in the morning or in the evening when everything had finished.
Was the rest of the beach mined and wired off?
Yeah. Yeah. And in the evenings, there was the Pally de Dance along... just off the sea front, where I think practically every night of the week there was a band playing and you used to go along and see who you could find.
No, well, I'm not going into that. But what was a night out like at the dance hall? Because there's nothing like that anymore.
No.
People just don't know. What would an evening like be at the Palais de Dance or whatever?
Well, we used to go as a group of lads. I mean, I was teetotal in those days. I'd never drunk beer in my life. And I suppose we used to look at the local talent that was there. And if you were lucky, you found somebody who was agreeable to dance with you. And that was it. And then I think it was 10 o'clock, we had to be back inside.
Were the bands good or modern up to the time?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Funnily enough, there was in my group, there was a lad by the name of Eric Bracewell. Now, how the heck have I remembered his name? He used to play the clarinet. And I think he was semi-professional from memory. I can actually picture the bloke, and I've not thought of him since 1941, for heaven's sake.
Any sport? I mean, you were a cricket fan. I mean, was there any cricket going on?
No, no.
Now, you at the end of it, you have examinations.
Yeah.
And you pass.
Yeah.
So what next?
We were then sent up to Wilmslow.
In Cheshire.
In Cheshire, which was a holding base for the RAF to be shipped off at Liverpool. And bearing in mind this was October, I think it was, or end of September, 41, we went on a convoy to train in America under the what they called the Arnold Scheme, when Churchill and Roosevelt had agreed, you know, this lease lend lark.
Now, anything happened at Wilmslow, or was that just a month of waiting?
Oh, absolutely. Nothing to do whatsoever except waiting for your convoy to go off.
And tell us about the convoy. What do you remember? Which ship were you on?
The Highland Princess, which was a ship used to import bananas. And we were in the refrigeration department in the hold. And it was pretty grotty. You weren't allowed to undress. The only thing you could take off with your boots, and you were slept in a hammock.
How did you take to that?
Not very well, because the next bloke's feet were about there, 6 inches away from your ears, so it helped put you to sleep. And the sea was pretty rough, because we went right up north to sort of Greenland.
This is November. Or October?
No, it was October, I'm sure. Beginning of October.
And what were the seasick? Seasick?
No, funny enough, I have never been seasick in my life, but most people were.
Were you very aware of the submarine threat?
Yeah, I'll tell you about that in a minute. The sea was very rough. And the overcrowding on the boat was unbelievable.
Tell us about...
And we were in...
How overcrowded were you?
Well, it was jammed. The hold where I was, it was absolutely... Don't ask me how many there were there, because I have no idea. But we were jammed, literally. The chap in the next hammock was as close as they could get you. And as I say, you were only allowed to take your boots off and you tied them to your hammock at night, and that was it. And it was a very, very large convoy. And there was one particular night where we were at boat stations all night.
Now, what's boat station? Just explain what you were doing.
Well, we were up on deck with our life jackets on, sort of shivering to death. And there was a lot of activity going on with the destroyers that were accompanying us, going up and down. You heard a lot of gunfire. Well, it wasn't gunfire. It was some depth charges going off. And I can remember in the morning when we were still at boat stations, the officer, OC Troops, he called himself, I think it was, proudly announced that they in actual fact had sunk a U-boat.
Had the U-boat sunk any ships, or was it?
Not that I know of. If they were, we weren't told about it. But there was a lot of flashes and gunfire and what have you all over the place. I mean, we were zigzagging like mad, as a convoy did.
Anything else about that convoy?
No, except one chap. I didn't know his name. If I did, I can't remember it. But one morning he committed suicide. He'd hung himself up with his belt. Hanged himself. But I can tell you the weather was so rough that when you went to the heads, you know, the toilets, where you've got a step that's... You had to take your shoes and socks off and roll up your trousers because it was floating in sick. It was quite revolting. For a couple of days, I can't remember anything other than, why did I join? But eventually, I don't know how many days we were at sea, but it was pretty slow. We woke up one morning and there were just two boats. The rest of the convoy disappeared, presumably down south, the east coast of America. And we landed at Newfoundland. What do they call it? St. John's? Or was it Halifax? I forget.
One or the other.
Do you know, I think it was St. John's we landed. And then we were taken by train to Toronto.
Now, that train journeys in Canada are quite spectacular. I mean, I don't know whether you went then onwards and across to the east, but
No, we went to Toronto.
Just to Toronto. What was the journey like?
Well, it was unbelievable in so much as that I can remember wonderful scenery and wonderful food. There was no rationing or anything. You could eat as much as you could get onto your plate. And I know we had an overnight, I can't remember how long that trip was, but it was from Halifax to Toronto. And I know the train journey involved a journey overnight. And when we got to Toronto, we were billeted in what they call the Empire Exhibition Buildings, which I think was it 1935, King George V, his jubilee. And there was an exhibition there. And we were in what was called the sheep pens. And they had bunks four high, all fairly basic, but quite friendly.
And then what?
We were there for about 10 days, I suppose. And I can remember a lovely lady by the name of Mrs. Thomas, who was a Welsh lady, had married a Canadian soldier in the First World War and had lived in Toronto ever since. And she marched in and said, I've got room for four. Anybody like to come out for a meal? And she took us home, and I was one of them. And I remained in touch with Mrs. Thomas until she died. In fact, she came to England when I first got married after the war and stayed with us. Lovely lady. She really was absolutely... We used to call her Mother Thomas.
And what was it like going to her place? What sort of hospitality did she offer?
Oh, absolutely wonderful. it was, if I remember rightly, it was just a meal, and she said, "There we are, help yourself." It was.
Now, what were you doing? You were in this Empire Exhibition Centre, or whatever it's called,
yes,
in Toronto.
Yes.
What were you actually doing during these 10 days? I presume this is still October. Well, it would be, yes.
Well, very little, really. We were waiting to go down to America. And, of course, we'd been, bearing in mind that this was before America was in the war, and we'd been issued with, believe it or not, a cardboard suitcase, which I've still got, incidentally, up in the roof, and a grey suit. Because on the train from Toronto to America, when we got to the border, we had to take our uniforms off, put on our suit, hide our uniform and the kit bag in the suitcase, and believe it or not, we all walked across the border into America. And that was to comply with the Geneva Convention. Sounds a bit daft, but that's what happened. And then we went by train all the way down to Georgia, where some lads went elsewhere, but I was a member in a number that went to Dar Aero Tech. Three words, DARR hyphen Aero, AERO, Tech, TECH. In Albany,
that?
In Albany, Georgia. And whenever we came off the station, we had to wear our... We weren't allowed off in uniform. And, of course, it was a civilian training ground. No military there.
Dar Aero Tech, that was a civilian.
Yeah. And our flying instructors were all civvies.
Now, what was the setup there? Tell us a bit about it.
Well... There were two classes. I was in class 42E, which meant that your class was due to graduate in May of 1942, the fifth month. And we were what were called lower classmen, where you were issued with goggles and you had to wear them round your neck until you soloed, and then you were entitled to wear them up on your forehead. There were American army there running what they called the PX, you know, the NAFI equivalent in America. And we were instructed on, again, meteorology.
Now, hang on. Were there civilian Americans there actually training or being trained?
Purely RAF. Purely RAF. Two classes. One US class 42E and the one before, which was 42D, which obviously was due to graduate in April.
And you got there still in October, roughly?
Yes, that was October, I'm certain.
So it's a six-ish month course, about, yeah. Now, how did they... What was your accommodation like? Before we go on to the actual training, what was your accommodation like there?
Well, as a lower classman, we were in... There were only two barracks upstairs. I know we had to go upstairs to them. And it was just like beds in a row. But the discipline was pretty hot because the orderly officer came round every morning with a pair of white gloves on and tested everything, that you made your bed properly and... Sorry about that.
You're right.
And there was no dust and everything was neat and tidy. And that, I seem to remember... It was about a 5-week period. And then when you got through that and you became what they called upperclassmen.
So that was just lectures in the lower class?
Oh, no, you were learning to fly as well.
Well,
half the day was flying, half the day lectures.
Well, what were the lectures? Let's do the lectures first.
So yeah.
What were the lectures covering?
Aerodynamics. Bit more advanced as to how an aircraft flew and that sort of thing. Meteorology. Basic training on what makes an engine work. Mechanics, I suppose they'd called it. I can't remember now. But I don't think there was anything else.
So you'd just be taking notes.
Yeah.
And learning this.
Yeah.
Ready for examination.
Yeah. And we had tests periodically all the way through. And it was the first time we had ever come across what is normally accepted today with exams, where you had a question and then you had four or say five alternatives, A, B, C, D, E. Was it, or was it, you know, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
So multiple choice answer.
Multiple choice, thank you, I couldn't think of that. Yes, that's right. And of course we flew.
Now, to take me, how did they, let's go, we're very interested in the process of training pilots, obviously.
Yeah.
So how did they first start? For, presumably, you'd never been in an aeroplane. So
no,
did
never
they
ever.
Start with an air familiarisation flight, just to take you up, to get you in an aeroplane? How, well, no, that's putting words in your mouth, sorry. How did you start?
Well, we were training on what they called steermans, and there are a few left, I believe. In fact, there's one that was at Shoreham not long ago, but I don't know if it's still there. But they were similar to a Tiger Moth, only a little bit more robust. Fantastic aircraft to fly, because you could make them stall and they'd come down like a lift. Didn't drop a wing or anything. They were absolutely fabulous. Wonderful start to flying.
Monoplanes or
no, biplanes. Just like a Tiger. And you, the first time you went up with your instructor on a familiarisation, and I can remember he did aerobatics, like looping the loop and a slow roll and one or two things, stall turns. And I know I felt sick, but I wasn't, thankfully. Because if you were, you had to clean the cockpit out afterwards.
Was it? It's an open cockpit.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Like the Tiger Moth.
That's right. And the only means of communication is through a mouthpiece, not electrics at all. You had earphones.
A gospel tube.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
First World War.
Yes.
That's right. And what did you think of it? I mean, you know, you felt a bit poorly, but then who wouldn't? Perhaps first time. I mean, what did you? Was it as good? Was it as good as you thought it would be?
I seem to remember it was absolutely fantastic. And that's for me, you know. And we were all the same.
It didn't put you off at all, the other way on. No, you liked it.
No. Couldn't wait to sort of fly it yourself.
Now, these aeroplanes, did they have a dual set of controls then?
Yes, both cockpits had controls.
And the instructor in front? Difficult to remember. It's all wrong.
Do you know, I can't remember. I think he was in front, wasn't he?
I think that's usually the case, but it's not necessarily the case.
No, I think he was in the front, yeah.
And you had a dual set of everything?
Yeah. Mind you, when you say everything, there weren't many instruments.
Well, let's go through.
Several of them were blacked out. So you were trained to fly in America by what they call the seat of your pants. When you came into land, for instance, you cut your throttle and you glided in. And if you had to use your throttle, you had to go round again.
Now, so what controls and instruments did you have?
You had the rudder bar and the joystick. Altimeter, horizontal, I'm not sure whether you had an airspeed indicator or not now, but I think that was it.
Now, they took you up for your air familiarisation flight. Now, how do they teach you to fly? You know, that's just taking you up, showing you the ropes, but how do they set about converting you from someone who never been in the air before, to someone who can do a solo flight?
Well, each instructor had four pupils. And before your flying lesson of the day, he would say, well, now, what we're going to do today is whatever. And he would show you what he meant by what he was going to do, like elementary turns, where I can remember you had to give, for instance, opposite rudder, because as you're turning to the left, your nose would drop, so you give opposite rudder to keep your nose on the horizon. And teaching you that to fly straight and level.
So he'd be discussing this with you on the ground.
On the ground before
you went up.
Taking
you through what might arise and what you should do.
That's right.
And then what did you think of him as an instructor? I don't know whether you remember his name. Probably
not. I do. It was Mr. Brandenburg. How about that?
Brandenburg. A civilian then?
Yeah.
Not Mr. I meant by that.
Well, Mr. Brandenburg. Yeah, don't ask me what his Christian name was. Or his first name, as one should say today, not Christian name.
Now, so he'd be briefing you. Now, what would happen when he went up? You'd go up in turn with him.
Yeah.
And what would a first flight, your first ever flight instruction be? What would he be teaching you? Or if it's difficult for you to do it like that, what's the program he'd take you through?
Well, I suppose the first thing you learn is to fly straight and level. Keeping your nose on the horizon and making sure you're level.
And what's the skill of that then? How do you do that?
You don't have to do very much, really. You just sit there. It all depends if you were flying straight into the wind or if you're in a crosswind. Obviously, you are yawing to a certain extent, so that the thing that you pick out on the horizon is gradually moving. If you've got the wind coming this way, your visibility is changing because you're yawing. So obviously, to fly in a straight line to that, you would be flying into wind slightly because you'll be going down that way, and you've got to get used to doing that to start with.
So you'd turn.
And then slight turns. And then I think one of the things that I found difficult early on was doing figures of eight.
Now, I should have asked, this isn't a rotary engine, obviously, or you wouldn't have had, trouble flying. This is an inline, a stationary engine.
Yeah.
So it's fairly stable.
Yeah.
Aircraft, not like some of the rotary ones.
No.
Right, so flying straight and level, then turns. Now, how would you do a turn? Tell me how you do a turn. Which controls would you use?
Well, bearing in mind, I haven't flown a plane since 1943. If you wanted to turn to the left, you would take your control column and ease it over. You had to learn very quickly that you only just lightly held the control column, not holding it, stiffly. And you would ease the rudder slightly so that you would turn and bank. And then after you've turned, you put on opposite rudder to make sure so the tailplane was keeping your nose, as I said just now, on the horizon. And then you did figures of eight, which meant that you had to pick out two items on the ground a little way apart, and you do figures of eight, making your wing, if you were doing the left-hand turns all the time, making sure that your wing stayed pointing at that object as you went round, and then you'd come round to the next one down there where you'd have to keep your right wing. Not easy as it sounds. I found that quite difficult to begin with.
So now, would he be taking his hands off the control during these sort of these three things, straight, turns, figures of eight? Would he be handing over to you to do this?
Yes, after an hour or so, yes. I mean, each flying lesson was, I don't know, half hour, three quarters, because he got four pupils, don't forget, to get through in the morning.
So he'd take off, in the early days, he'd take off, get you to the height, and then hand over.
That's right. Yeah.